Welcome to the Onyx Pathcast. My name is Matthew Dawkins, and I am accompanied by my colleagues, Dixie Cochran.
Hello.
And Eddie. What was that?
Hello.
Hello. Hello.
And Eddie Webb.
I can't top that. Hello.
Hello. Well, off to a raring start there. Thank you, Dixie. We are discussing in this podcast emotions in role-playing games and emotions between podcast hosts. Like frustration.
We do a deep dive into our relationship.
It's frustration, irritation, exasperation, and other Asians. No.
What about before, like exhilaration? Like, come on.
We might get there by happiness. We might get there by the end
happiness
of the podcast.
Isn't an Asian.
Happy Asian. Happy nation.
Happy Asian.
Appalachian. Anyway, Appalachians. We should move on from this. This gay banter, and talk a little. How's your week been, Dixie? What have you been working on?
Chicago by Night. All of this is coming out later than that. You just dated this very weirdly.
We do it every single week. We never intend to, but it happens every single week. Yeah, at this point, we exist in a nether realm. Ooh, I like that. A nether realm of game development.
I've been working on Chicago by Night. I have been working on a Fantasy Flight thing I can't talk about. And it was my birthday this week, so yay.
You dated it yourself. Hooray!
Oh, you started it, so I just went with it.
If anything, I would say that dates it more. Okay, no, cool. No. Well, either way. So
if they know where the birthday is, if they don't, then they don't.
So in the full knowledge that I'm the developer of Chicago by Night, and you may excoriate me, how is that editing going?
It's going really well. I am enjoying it a lot. Your books generally come to me fairly clean. And as always with books like this, where different people write different chapters or sections, like sometimes I'll be tooling along, not doing a whole lot for several pages, and then all of a sudden I hit a section where I'm like, "Oh, this is all in passive voice. I'm gonna fix it." Yeah. Which happens when you have multiple writers. Not everybody has the exact same strengths and weaknesses. But yeah, it's been really fun. I'm still salty that one of the chapters is literally 100,000 words long, because that is a book. That's a book in and of itself. it's really great, and I can't wait to see it once it's all laid out and everything in the future.
Do you have any favorite characters from it?
Oh, gosh. I mean, I was talking to you, Chris, about this in our last episode. Like, I do really like Prince Jackson. I think he's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. But also, I've talked before that things go straight out of my head right after I read them, so I'd have to be just, like, describing them for the most part. I don't remember names very well. But there were definitely quite a few characters in the big kindred section that I thought were a lot of fun. So, I'm not going to be able to remember their names unless I sit here and start scrolling back through the document.
Right. It's that one empire with the fangs and the thing.
Yeah, that one.
They're in a clan. It's great. Right. They eat people. I don't know.
I noticed when I was developing that one, because Kevin Jackson, the Prince of Chicago, spoilers, is in the previous two Chicago by Nights, and he has siblings that are all supposed to be his childer. They don't appear in Chicago by Night because he's dispatched them off to different domains. And in the previous books, he has four siblings. Mm-hmm. So there are five Jacksons. You can see where this is going. And I only realized this in development when I started including the pieces about his siblings in minor detail. I thought, oh, do I still do this, and do I make any reference to it? And then I thought, no, absolutely not. From now on, he has three siblings. There are the Jackson Four, because I really hate those kind of in-jokes, I've got to be honest. Yeah. What about you, Eddie? What have you been doing over the last week or so?
Well, speaking of in-jokes, I've been working on Pirates of Pugmire Art Direction with Rich. We've been talking over what we're going to do with that. And also Aberrant Art Direction, now that I think about it. I'm doing a lot of art direction conversations this week. But they're both very different, because with Pirates, we're trying to not only come up with a visual direction for all the lizard and bird groups, but also just give them that distinct flair. We want this book to very be piratical. You know, I want it to be like a nice nautical vibe without being too over the top. Mm-hmm. Which for Pugmire is always a tricky balance. I've talked about this before, about, you know, it's so easy to go over the top with it, and you want to kind of get just right below the top. You know, it's like, right. Just right there.
And you'll be releasing... Oh, sorry, you'll be releasing a design diary for Pirates of Pugmire at some point, won't you?
Oh, yes, actually. Good segue. During the stages of developing Pirates of Pugmire, whenever I would finish up a chunk of work, I sat at my computer and recorded about 5-10 minutes of what was happening at that moment in the project. So at some point in the near future, I'm going to edit those together into an actual episode of the podcast, so that way people can hear more or less from start to finish. I have maybe some redundancies I'll have to edit out, but in general, just from start to finish, what I was going through, what I was thinking about during the process, and get a better sense of what it's like to actually step-by-step go through a development process.
That'll be fun for people like me to read, too, just to, like, kind of get in your head for your whole development process, as opposed to, like, asking you kind of random questions throughout the week, as I often do.
Well, I mean, I'm happy to do both, but, I mean, that was kind of the reason why I did it, is I've listened to one of my favorite audio drama companies is Big Finish, and sometimes they'll do similar things at the end of their talk about the production of a particular audio drama. And I thought it was really fascinating to hear kind of day by day, you know, what's been happening and what's kind of going on at the moment. So yeah, I'm hoping it's another way to get people understanding of what it's like to hear a product from start to finish. And because it's Pugmire, you know, I don't have to worry about running it by a licensor. I don't have to worry about somebody else's marketing plan. I could just talk about it directly.
I've been doing a similar thing for Cults of the Blood Gods. I tossed and turned over whether to do it because it's a licensed product. It's obviously Paradox owned, and we are happily licensing it to do it. So yep. I wondered about how much information I could actually reveal, but I'm putting it together. Like you, I've been doing these small recordings at the different stages that we've got to so far. And it doesn't take a huge amount of effort to do. So if I get to the end of the process and I think, yeah, this contains a little too much behind the curtain, it's no big deal to scrap it. But I've certainly not been...
You mentioned it, and if we do scrap it, people are like, oh, but I wanted to hear the episode, so, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, it'll be like one of our magnificent lost episodes, the best ones. It's that Tom Baker episode of Doctor Who that was never filmed, but has... There you go.
I'm a nerd.
Geek. What have you been doing with Aberrant?
There's two parts to that. One is that because we want to really lean more into the comic book nature of Aberrant, Rich and I have been talking with Mike Chaney about how we can get more of that vibe in there. One of the things that we're talking about possibly doing is actually having comic page spreads as opposed to opening fiction for the chapters. So we're sorting that out. But one thing we did do is we are going to have a introductory comic put together, the 22-page comic, digital comic. And so we got Paul Jenkins, who's a well-respected comic book writer, to write that for us. And it's actually going through the art process now. So that's really exciting. It's something we've never really done before. And it was great to – luckily, Paul lives here in Atlanta, so I run into him at conventions a couple times, so we have a personal relationship, and he was able to kind of, yeah, sure, I'll work on that with you guys. But it was just so exciting to work with him and see his side of things, and he's just chatting with him, and it's like, oh, yeah, and I learned this thing when I started working with Alan Moore, and it's like, whoa, back up, what? Oh, yeah, I mean, Alan talk all the time. It's like, you just drop that in the conversation. Unpack that a bit. You know, so, I mean... But yeah,
let's see if we can drop Alan Moore into our book as well.
But just seriously, that'd be great. But he's, I understand, pretty retired now.
So he keeps claiming.
He keeps on retiring. But yeah, so no, it's exciting to kind of try some new stuff.
Well, it appears quite inadvertently we've done all our sort of promo for products at the front end of this podcast, and I quite like that. So yeah. Before we get onto the topic, because I'm the master of prevarication, it would appear... Contagion Chronicle is on Kickstarter.
Yes.
And Dixie, as the overseer of the Chronicles of Darkness line, what's been your read on fan reactions to this book?
People seem to really like it. I know there was some skepticism about how you were going to do, you know, every crossover ever. I think that Megan's mechanics for that and her factions are absolutely amazing.
Yes.
And I think that once people started kind of seeing how we did it and seeing what we did with it, they got really into the idea of being able to play a mixed group of Chronicles, you know, types, where you can play a Promethean and a Changeling and a vampire and a beast and whatever all in one group. Because I think that's always been something that people have kind of, you know, done in both World of Darkness and Chronicles of Darkness, but they've always had to kind of, you know, make it work. Like, it's always been very homebrewy for the most part.
Yeah.
So actually giving them the setting, and then there's so many plot hooks. And setting ideas in every book that you do, Matthew. I know that's kind of one of your big rules for writers is like, don't waste a sentence that could have a plot hook in it. Which even Eddie called me on when I was writing for Pirates of Pugmire, which was cool. He's like, oh, this could be a better plot hook if you did it this way. And I was like, you are correct. Thank you. So, you know, there's so much setting, there's so much plot. I know as people get some of the later chapters, it's usually when folks get even more excited. But I've seen comments all over the place, both on the Discord and on the forums and on blog comments, where people are kind of like, I wasn't sure about this, but then I read the first, you know, chapter and it's the best thing ever, or I'm so excited to play this, or yeah. The other thing that I like that we're doing with the Kickstarter is we do have add-on bundles for all of our core books.
Mm.
So if you want to dive deeper into one of the splats or all of the splats or none of the, you know, whatever, then you can add those on for a very, very steep discount, which is super cool.
Yeah.
I have enjoyed, you know, that there's obviously a lot of pride that goes into when you see people on our forums saying, my favorite faction is, you know, my favorite Sworn group is, they really appeal to me, or I could see myself using this Vectra in that way, or this antagonist in the Edinburgh chapter is absolutely terrifying. I love it when a fan says something written is terrifying, because it's a nice strong word. A nice strong word. I'll edit that. Now I'm going to have to edit that. Fuck. fuck this podcast. We'll start again. No. Now none of this could be edited. I've ruined it. So back to Contagion Chronicle Kickstarter. it will be going for a couple of weeks yet. So now that I've tripped over my own tongue repeatedly, we should talk a little about emotions.
How do you feel about have some emotions right now?
What emotions am I feeling right now? Oh, humiliation, Eddie. Humiliation. I wish I hadn't logged on. You should have just sent me out the airlock again. First thing I wanted to talk about with emotion, and okay, so let's preface this. Emotion at the gaming table is a pretty frequent thing. I mean, part of the, I guess, dramatic process of role-playing is to evoke some emotion from yourself or from others. You want to role-play in a way that grabs people, whether it's just the person running the game or the other players. If you're all just role-playing in a vacuum and no one's reading or listening to your work, then there's certainly less satisfaction to be had. So particularly strong role-play can make someone happy or sad or angry or what have you. And sometimes those emotions can be incredibly positive. Sometimes they can lead to negative reactions. And sometimes there's bleed between in-character experience and out-of-character feelings. And we thought it would be an interesting thing to discuss on this podcast, both about some of the games that we work on that are known for creating those feelings and maybe how to manage them or best to get the best experiences out of them. Tell some anecdotes about our experiences with these emotions at the table, but also to talk about that in-character, out-of-character divide. And with that particular latter point in mind, I wanted to speak to you, Dixie.
Okay.
Yes, well, I'm glad, because that would have been an awful segue if you hadn't.
Dixie, hello, Dixie!
We've lost her. So, in character and out of character, I've only role-played with you barely. I think our first role-playing experience was at Midwinter.
Yes.
And so I don't know how well you balance in character and out of character. Perhaps you could explain what your experiences are of the two.
You mean how I like separate them kind of, or
yes, please.
Or don't? Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
So I know that a lot of people, like, I have a lot of friends in the LARP community, things like that. They get so into their characters and they have to, like, you know, come down after a LARP weekend or this, that, and the other. And I don't know. I have, like, two theories on this. One is because I do have a background in acting, so I'm always very aware that I'm acting.
Yeah.
Or the other one is just that I have a lot of anxiety and I don't want to, like, cry in front of people or get so wrapped up in something that I start feeling, like, that I start feeling bad because I don't want to, like, kick off a depressive episode because my character died or whatever, you know? I lean more toward the acting part of it. Like, I acted all through middle and high school. I got into role-playing around the same time. So, you know, I can act like my character is sad or mad or happy or whatever, even if I'm not necessarily feeling that.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to react to things appropriately, and I try to, you know, consider what my character would do in a certain situation. But I've never really had that experience where something happened in game and me out of game was shocked or horrified or actually sad. It just doesn't affect me like that. Like, it's a game. It doesn't affect me. I've honestly had video games that I cried at more than role-playing games.
Oh, that's interesting.
Stuff like Life is Strange or whatever, where I'm like, oh god, I have feelings kind of messing with the story.
Mm.
Yeah, but like, when I'm playing a game, I'm just acting. And it also might just be that I haven't played as serious of games as some of y'all have. I found that very few of the tabletop games I've played have been very serious horror or very serious, like, heavy emotional stuff. It's more been adventures and one-shots and, you know, things of that nature. Like, most of my long-form campaigns got, you know, a little silly here and there.
Right.
Because it was a bunch of friends around the table playing for, like, 8 hours at a time.
Mm.
And sometimes we would just get, you know, a little punchy, a little weird. But we never really got, like... Like, no one at the table ever got like that in my super long campaigns that I remember. Any emotions that happened were usually related to out-of-character things. So I'm a little bit of a weird one with this, because like I said, like, I didn't learn the term bleed until I friended a lot of people in the LARP community, and I kept seeing blog posts like, how to handle bleed, how to manage bleed, and I'm like, people actually, that happens?
Mm-hmm.
Like, people get sad because their character was sad? I don't... What?
Well, I don't think that's... I don't think you're too unusual as a result of that. I think it's just people are more likely to post about it if they do suffer from bleed or experience bleed. It's not necessarily something you suffer.
Right.
Than if you don't, because likewise, I guess compartmentalization is the term often used for these things.
Mm-hmm.
I, for the most part, my roleplay has always held a pretty firm in-character and out-of-character distinction.
Right.
There's been... I remember when I went to the Convention of Thorns, which is the grand, or was the grand, Vampire the Masquerade LARP that took place in Poland in a big castle, and the production values were massive, which may have had some serious knock-on effects to the company running it.
Mm-hmm.
And but everyone was so into their characters. It was a wonderful experience, flawed in some ways, but as an experience, it was incredibly grand.
Mm-hmm.
Now, someone who attended that convention before me said, the year before, he said to me, if you're going to Convention of Thorns, you're going to need a few days break afterwards to really cool down after this game. Mm-hmm. And I'd LARPed a little before. I've never been a massive LARPer, to be honest. And I said to him, oh, myself and one of the people I was traveling with, we're intending on going to Gross Rosen concentration camp on the way back, because we were driving back through Germany, and it was the... It sounds ridiculous. It was the closest concentration camp to the castle, and it was en route. I have never been to a concentration camp. I thought it would be a respectful thing to do, and I'm very interested in that history.
Yeah.
And he said, oh, God, don't do that. You will be a complete bawling mess. Or you won't be able to divide the horror you experience during the LARP from the horror of the reality of the war, and that will be even worse. And I thought, that doesn't sound like me.
Right.
And we did go to Gross Rosen concentration camp, and it would sound flippant to say I was absolutely fine, because I wasn't. It is a terrible thing when you're in a concentration camp. But certainly I didn't feel like my experience role-playing somehow jarred me emotionally. But on the flip side of that, I mentioned on one of the previous podcasts we did about that time I played a character who had been forcibly embraced, and she was very much traumatized by it. And when one of the other characters said to her, you want it, you got off on it, I was shaking at the table. Mm-hmm. It was an adrenaline rush, as explained to me one of the other players, because by the end of that game, I was still shaking. My voice was quavering, and I had no control over it. So I've had a bit of both, but for the most part, I've always been able to make the distinction. What about you, Eddie? Have you ever experienced bleed?
So I am much more in the category of someone who does generally experience it in extreme cases. And I think some of that is because I have a much stronger live action history than perhaps both of you do. I've been doing it.
I've learned like four times.
Right, I've been doing it almost 20 years. So I mean, you know, it's not the form of the art that I grew up on, but certainly it was the one that was most, I think, shaped me as a player. I was a quick digression. We'll talk about bleed briefly because it is a term that's only recently come into vogue. But some people may not have heard it yet. And the concept is pretty simple in the sense that, as it's usually used, is that the things you're experiencing in character impact you out of character. And that's kind of what you've alluded to. It does work in reverse. If you're having a bad day at work, playing a happy, fun game can help that mood, and also can impact how you play. It may take you a while to get into the happy, fun game if you're having a bad day. So, but for a long time, I didn't have the terminology for that. I just knew that I would have these weird emotions during and after game, and sometimes that leads to problems. I have certainly heard of people who have their characters have fallen in love, and that romantic relationship has led to one, if not both, of the people involved in that. Sometimes that turns out well, but generally it doesn't, because there's expectations and there's all sorts of communication issues that occur with that. So, I mean, it is sometimes a problem. But on the other side, I've certainly seen people who get catharsis or get benefit out of playing through things in their lives in live action games. I know a few different people, a few different friends, who have come out as a result of playing characters in live action because they got a chance to explore this part of themselves and realize, oh, it's generally going to be okay if I take this step, and gotten the courage as a result of playing through that. So there is some benefits also come from this. As I've gotten older, however, I have found that I don't get as wound up. And I don't know if that's experience or just because I'm 40 now and just things aren't as white hot emotional as they were when I was 20. I think that may be a little bit column A, a little bit column B. Matthew ran me through a Wraith game at Dragon Meet. That was very dark. But I enjoyed expressing those dark emotions, but I didn't walk away going feeling shaken. I felt that's awful, and I had intellectually understood that was a terrible experience, but I didn't feel like I had been through a terrible experience as much. So I'm wondering if some of that is also age.
Well, I think while you were speaking, what you've said has made me have something of an epiphany about my role playing and why I may not be having these experiences. And like you say, by no means are they always negative. Mm-hmm. To have some kind of emotional feedback from your role play can lead to some kind of great self-actualization, I guess. But a way I always position myself in games, even if my character, I think, isn't supposed to be, is I always take on a role of control. If I'm an NPC, I am always most comfortable being in a vampire game, a primogen or a prince, as an example. Sure. But by running games at the tabletop, which I largely do rather than play, I have complete control over the environment, what the NPCs are going to say, the encounters and all of that. In LARPs, even if my character starts on the bottom rung, I am going to make every damn effort to get on top. And I don't mean I'm going to just power game my way through. I will make it a believable part of the character's plot. And I think it's because that's my comfort zone. I wonder how emotionally impacted I would be to play through a game where I was actively role-playing someone who was constantly being trod upon or otherwise humiliated. It doesn't appeal to me. That's the thing. There's no desire in me to experience that, so I don't want to particularly do it just to see what might happen.
Right.
Weirdly, same. I almost always end up as the leader of any party that I'm in, whether it's D&D or whatever else. I went to an ongoing LARP twice recently, and by the second session, I was a Toreador principal.
Of course, absolutely.
Because the main one wasn't doing anything.
And you were playing a brew hub.
But yeah, so kind of the same way, and also kind of the same feeling about it. I actually recently, I have someone who's been trying to figure out a game to run for me, and I keep saying, like, I want to play Exalted, I want to play D&D, I want to play whatever else, because for me, I think I've mostly used role-playing as a way to be the hero in a fantasy story. Like, right. That's what I want to do with it. That's what makes it fun for me. Whether it's a vampire fantasy story or a, you know, whatever, like, I like that. I enjoy that. Even if you're playing the bad guy. And so, like, they started suggesting some stuff that was a little bit more, like, super low-key, a little more like, oh, you're playing immortal. And I'm like, that's not fun. I can't do that every day. Like, I'm already immortal. That's all I do. I walk around as a person all the
roll
time.
Your pay taxes boring. Roll.
Right, yeah. So, like, I want to play a big, sweeping fantasy-type game. And even, like, some of the, like, samurai games were mentioned and a few other things, like a Bronze Age type game, and I was like, no, I want magic powers. I want to shoot fireballs or have a giant sword or whatever. And that's my favorite thing. Granted, I'm fine with urban fantasy too, but even then, I tend to end up being the decision maker at a lot of tables.
Yeah.
Or being the, like, level-headed one.
That's really interesting. I feel like we're kind of exploring something we didn't intend to, which always makes for an interesting podcast from my perspective.
Yeah.
Because even, well, as you mentioned, Bronze Age games, games that are, I guess, theoretically mundane, you know, procedural games as well, mission-based games, like Conspiracy X is one that I used to play a lot of as well, where although there are weird things going on, your characters very rarely have access to them. Mm-hmm. They appeal to me far less than games where, I guess, to use a rather loaded term, I enjoy more of a power fantasy.
I literally just said that. It's okay.
But that said, I think I could very much enjoy other trips like that, where I guess I'm in a military role or a police officer's role, despite no desire to do anything like that in real life.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I think I do wonder how emotional my response would be to playing someone on the complete opposite end of that.
Right.
Certainly I've played characters that have died or have met other grisly fates, but to go through an entire session like that, I mean, even if I'm playing a ghoul in a LARP of Vampire the Masquerade, usually I'll be the one who's whispering in the ear of the vampire what he or she should do next, rather mm-hmm. than saying, yes, master, whatever you say, master. So, yeah, interesting. But, Eddie, I know you wanted to speak a little about the Bodhana group, but before, if there was something else you wanted to say on this subject beforehand, please feel free.
Well, actually, that was something that does lead into that. In a sense that it is really interesting you guys both key into a power dynamic. Because I have found that some of my more emotional roleplay does come from a place where I don't have power. In particular, a lot of my early emotional roleplay in LARP was when I was playing part mm-hmm. of an Anarch gang. And so we were, by design, hey, no, thump on us. And it helped that the people in power and the camera side were also very good friends of ours. So we could have a conversation ahead of time and say, no, it's cool to just go off on this. And really kind of lean into it. And then we get that kind of emotional rush of, we know it's safe, but still we can enjoy that experience. But I mean, I also don't think that you mentioned that power fantasy can be a loaded term, and I agree that it is a loaded term. I disagree that it should be, because I'm curious. I would wonder if one of the benefits both of you perhaps get from that is a chance to have some control in a life where perhaps you may feel like you don't have so much control. It's like, you know, in this space, I got to do something or accomplish something, you know? And we all feel powerless day to day. And there are times where I feel that way when I'm like, you know, I had a really bad day at work. This is more when I was in an office, on a bad day at the office, and I want to go and just, I want to just beat up monsters today because that will give me a sense of satisfaction of, I got to accomplish something here. Get my frustrations out. But it does tie into something that I've been trying to say a lot more in the past year or so, is that there is some therapeutic potential in tabletop role-playing game, but it's not the same as therapy. And there is a great group called the Bodhana Group, B-O-D-H-A-N-A, for people want to look it up. They are licensed therapists who are using tabletop role-playing games in therapeutic scenarios. And it's fascinating. I ran into them. Actually, they ran into me because they found a lot of value in using Pugmire in their sessions. I was like, what? Really? This is amazing. But they would unpack it, and they say the kind of using of animal archetypes combined with the be a good dog, you know, tagline, for lack of a better term, is a great place to kind of unpack that in a very safe environment, because we culturally are, for thousands of years, have been raised on stories of animals in moral stories, you know, Aesop's fables, and, you know, lots of mythological stories use animals and these things. So it was interesting to me that people are actually using these tools that can have therapeutic use in their in clinical, you know, structured, licensed therapeutic sessions. So I mean, it's there's definitely a lot here. Role playing games can inspire emotions, but also you have to be careful with that. You know, there's when a lot of our games come out, there's these kind of push and pull of being respectful of people and respectful of say their trauma or their identity. And then other people who want to push hard on that and say, well, if you don't want to play these darker things, then you're weak or you're lesser or somehow. And that's just not fair to put that on people. It's like the amount of emotion you put into it should be an opt-in situation, not forced on you from an outside perspective. If you're not comfortable with the game, you should leave the game.
Absolutely. And a lot of people don't. A lot of people feel obliged because they're my friends or because I signed up, I made a costume or whatever, that they have to play through it even if they're not enjoying it. But that is definitely not the case. Personal health always comes first. It certainly should. But it's interesting what you're saying, that in some ways the idea of taking on the role of, a powerful character is a need to exercise power you don't have in your real life, for instance.
As a guess. I mean, I'm not saying it's always the case.
No, I think for some people that's definitely the case. For others, it probably isn't. I like to think that I've got a pretty firm distinction in my head between what I do in character and what I am out of character. But it's a very interesting assumption.
I want to steal briefly hostship because I want to ask Dixie a question. I was going to answer it, but I couldn't find a spot for it, so I'm just going to make a spot now. Because you're one of the people who have probably the most training as an actor of the three of us, are there just things you learned from that maybe are almost inadvertently or subconsciously helping you in this divide?
I don't know if that's the case so much for me, being, you know, someone who didn't like get into like the Methodist school of acting, as it were. It's more that I was just never trained to like, yes, you want to get in the character's head a little bit when you're playing a character, but the same way that we all do for role playing, where you think about their background, you might think about where they're from, you know, you think about whatever their story has been so far, which is something that you are encouraged to do in theater, usually, is kind of like maybe make up some things about the character you're playing that aren't established in the story, just so that you can make choices on stage. But it was always very much like a you know, clinical, not even clinical, but just, you know, it's something that you just have to do. It's just part of the process. And so when I got into role playing games, I was like, oh, cool, same process, you know, like.
Well, that's actually what I'm curious about, is because it sounds like a lot of people, there's no right way to play a role-playing. I mean, there is and there isn't. I mean, like, usually a lot of people are first exposed to role-playing games, they learn it as they go. It's kind of like, you know, mm-hmm. on-the-job training, for lack of a better term. But it sounds like because you had this other prior training, you were able to kind of tap into that, as opposed to, I don't know what happened, so I'll just dive in head first with all my emotions on my
Yeah, and I mean, to like, because you're playing a character, and that was always kind of, you know, the main thing you know about role-playing when you start playing, is I would often take a character I liked from a book or something and just modify them. So I already had this character in my head. I already kind of knew how they acted, knew what their background was. And then I just added details and changed things as I went. I mean, I've said a couple times on the podcast, I think, that the Scion LARP I played at Midwinter, I basically was Jessica Jones. Because the character's background was kind of Jessica Jonesy, and I was like, oh, well, I know this character. I can play her. And so I, like, styled myself a little bit like her, that, you know, it was fun. But also it was definitely a choice I made to kind of, like, latch onto that. And I think that tendency, if we're just, like, unpack how I operate here, comes from the fact that I am not the same kind of creative as you two are, which we've talked about before, at least privately. I'm not sure we talked about it on the podcast. But I am not a writer who has stories in their head that want to come out. I don't want to make up new things for the most part. I am good at following an outline. I am good at working within an established world. I'm not good at making up my own worlds. That's part of why I don't like running games so much, is because the improv aspect really, really causes me anxiety, because I'm always afraid I'm doing, like, I'm, you know, that people aren't having fun or that I'm doing the wrong thing. And so I think that I've always just kind of cribbed from other characters I like, just so I can, you know, have something to fall back on if I don't know what to say or do in a moment. So that's kind of my process, which I know is not everybody's process. I know so many people are like, I'm going to make up something brand new, which I did when we made Scion characters. That one was very much, like, kind of out of my head. But even then, like, her name is definitely, like, an homage to a character I like. You know, I always kind of do that. Because thinking of names is hard.
But what's interesting? No, it is. But what's interesting to me is when I first started running Pugmire for people who've never played a role-playing game before at all, almost always what they would do is they'd go to their pets and then start playing what they think their pet would do.
Because an established character you have in your world.
Yeah.
Exactly right. So I don't think it's actually as odd as between the three of us it might seem, because I've seen a lot of people who do. I do that sometimes. Like, one of my favorite D&D characters is basically a Assassin's Creed character, but it's also a half-elf. I mean, I drew from an established pop culture character. I used, in the 13th age game I'm playing, a paladin that based off of, I very clearly said, it's based off of Idris Elba. You know, it's like, and everyone has, cool, I get what your character's like, so I talk. I'm not going to try to emulate his voice, because his voice is amazing. But they can hear his voice when I'm talking, and they go, they get better what I'm trying to do, because I had that kind of shortcut, you know? So it helps me, and it helps the players, too. So, I mean, I think the shortcuts are actually really good, but it's a bit of a digression. I was just curious, because you have so much, well, you have some acting.
Yeah, I wouldn't say so much, but yeah.
Well, I have zero, so I've had one voice acting lesson once, so it's like almost zero. No, I appreciate you taking time to dig into that. That's really, really interesting to me. I'm going to mull on that for a bit.
Well, Eddie, of our games, because some of our games likely carry more emotional weight than others for the majority, and I was wondering what your thoughts were on what emotions you've seen at the tabletop as a result of playing our games or running our games, and which games in particular seem to bring those emotions to the fore.
I think a lot of people point to Wraith as kind of the default emotion generator. You know? Usually people play Wraith, it's like, oh my god, I had such it means a tense experience and whatnot. And I think that's, we've talked about in the deep dive, that I think part of that is because the emotions are part of the mechanics.
Yeah.
You know, and we dug into that. So it's very on the page.
Well, I would add to that. I would add to that just briefly that I think it's also because death is something that everyone, almost everyone, can relate to. Werewolves fighting evil corporations is more fantastical.
You can't relate to that?
Once upon a time in my giddy youth, but but I'm less hairy now, so. Getting back to Wraith.
But I mean, I think that you very nicely segue into where I was going to go, in the sense that a lot of people who do find emotional resonance in different games, it kind of comes from a bit of a cultural perspective. I have a lot of friends who are very, let's just say, anti-establishment. They have a disregard or a distrust of politicians, police, what have you. And for me, when I was growing up with this, a lot of them would gravitate to Vampire the Masquerade because it's very urban. It was literally the gothic punk game. You know, it was on the banner for a while. And so for in my head, it was like, oh, Vampire is kind of the anti-establishment, or at least a piece of that component. And then when I moved to Georgia, I found a lot of people here really gravitated to Werewolf. But I think it's because culturally, you know, these are people that are much more, you know, there's a lot more woodlands around here. Atlanta is definitely an urban city, but like if you move outside of Atlanta, it does get a little more rural. And a lot of the people who live in those rural areas much more gravitated to Werewolf's form of rebellion against corporations, as opposed to Vampire's rebellion against the old and the powerful. So, I mean, I think it's some of it depends on where you're coming from. I've seen people get teary over Pugmire. You know, I mean, it really does depend. But I think the reason why our games generally kind of hold up for that is because we think about these things. Mm,
yeah.
We've talked a lot about inclusivity, and this is kind of the conclusion of that argument. If people can see themselves in our games, they're going to resonate with them more, and it's going to lead towards more of an emotional reaction because they can. It's not just abstract.
So I think it's a big do you think is well? And I pitch this to both of you, and it applies also to acting. But what do you think is the easiest emotion to evoke, either as a GM, an actor, a role player? You want to get an emotion from your fellow players. What do you think is easy to draw out?
I'm just thinking, it depends on what character you're playing.
That's true, yeah.
It depends on what game you're playing. In my last big D&D campaign that I talked about on the Tell Us About Your Character episode, when I was playing my halfling, who was just full of joy. I could make everybody be very bloodthirsty but very happy about it really quickly. Because she was, you know, like I said, she was kind of a like chaotic good kind of character where she was just like, everything that's evil has to die. We're gonna go kill everything that's evil. And even if like our GM tried really hard to be like, that necromancer had a wife and kids, and I was like, but he was evil. So I'm like, I don't care. He was evil. He had a skeleton army. He should have died. I'm like, what?
The evil wife and kids.
I mean, we can send them his money. I don't know. Like, that's fine. It's probably not their fault. Like, but like, she's like just eternally optimistic. I don't GM very much, so I have trouble answering from that perspective. But generally, sure. I think just getting people excited about whatever we're doing is fun for me and something that I really enjoy, especially since I tend to play characters in the leadership role. You know, it's like no, let's go that way, because you know, like, I find it so boring in a role-playing game to spend like 4 hours trying to figure out how you're gonna get somewhere or which way you're gonna go when you have no actual goal in mind. So I'm just like, cool, that way looks cool, let's go that way and see what happens down there, which sometimes really annoys GMs because they want you to go the other way, and it's like, but, well, it's not my fault.
that's honestly fascinating to me, because I am the complete opposite. It makes it sound like my games are not fun at all. Brief aside, one day we will explore what the subject of fun means in role-playing games, but it won't be today.
No, we won't. We're never gonna do that. We're never gonna do that episode.
Because genuine joy is something I draw out of my players the least, I think. I think everyone, I would hope everyone's happy to have played a game, but I guess it goes back to Bleed. The idea of doing something in character that makes the characters happy because they've been rewarded or whatever, they've achieved a goal, and has a knock-on effect to the players, making them all smiley and happy and jokey and laughing around the table. That is something I so rarely, I guess, aim for. That may sound bizarre for someone who runs lots of games. But it's an emotion I think I've struggled to pull out of players before, a feeling of genuine joy.
Well, I would also argue that I'm much more extroverted and talkative than you are, and that's just my personality more than anything else.
Yep.
What Eddie, about you, Eddie?
And actually, I was gonna say it's like I think we need to think about, I'm gonna use academic terms, but we have to have the liminal space of the game. You know, when you sit down to play, if you're sitting down to play Call of Cthulhu, your first instinct is not going to
pass. Oh, yeah, exactly.
If you're going to sit down to play Pugmire, you're assuming dog puns are on the table. That's just going to default part of the game. I think what the players are opting into, what they're expecting, if you style yourself as a game master that runs a very serious game, you're going to get relatively serious reactions. And then if you do get laughter, it's going to be more of a kind of a joke before things get worse
right.
kind of scenario. Whereas if you pitch a game as lighthearted or humorous, people are going to start from that assumption. And then if it gets dark, again, that's going to counterbalance and leaven the humor. And D&D generally kind of hits a mid-spot of adventure. You know, you're on an adventure and it's a fun adventure. It can go dark, it can go lighter, but D&D kind of hits that rough spot. Whereas horror games or modern day games generally hit a spot that's a bit lower. It hits more drama, you know, and so you're gonna get a dramatic response from people. I've been able to kind of pull, well, I don't try to manipulate people's emotions. Something I used to do when I was a young game master. I would like, you know, if we're running a horror game, I would turn the lights down low and play creepy music and turn the lights on. And I realized not only was it distracting for me, but it was distracting for some other people, specifically non-neurotypical people. Something kind of very distracting, difficult to focus. So I've kind of just ditched all that. I do think that how you organize the table and the kinds of people you bring to the table is going to help. I mean, I played in a D&D game with a bunch of people. This is why I mentioned earlier. We set it in kind of a Renaissance Italy style setting. And so it's like, we all came to the table going, we're going to do a very swashbucklery kind of game. And near the end of that chronicle, we would spend entire game sessions without rolling dice. Because I would like, I'm trying to get out of a romantic entanglement with this one NPC while the other player is trying to get into a romantic entanglement with a different NPC and they hate each other and all those kinds of you know, swashbuckling on one person escaping out of jail, you know, that kind of stuff that you expect to see. We really, as players, leaned into those tropes. Mm-hmm. And so we got a certain flavor and vibe out of it. The Game Master definitely helped with that. The players also have to kind of bring that to the table. So the players are all on board with, like, we're going to really dig deep and have a strong emotional response, and we're communicating that. It can be wonderful. But I think if people are on the same page, like convention games, I found convention games generally tend to shoot lighter because not everyone's comfortable with each other. Mm. So it's easier to go into jokes and humor and outside table talk.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, that's what I was going to say. It's like that, then otherwise.
That's okay, awesome. Yeah, that's kind of my other point to that is that I have not played very many long campaigns since like high school. I played a couple of D&D games that ran, you know, a few sessions. I'd say like 12 or so max. But I haven't run like a really long game or like played in a really long game since I was probably 21, 22. So a lot of my experience recently has been one-shots, and a lot of them have been at the event I used to do in Connecticut called Drinking and Dragons, which if you're in the Connecticut area, you should go to. It's really fun. Where they just do a night of one-shots, and people bring food, and they bring drinks, and it's in this big, cool space. There's usually like 15 games being run there. But because of the nature of that space, it's not like it's a one shot. Like I'm not going to get super deep in there. I will say I have played a horror game in there. It was a Call of Cthulhu session where at some point somebody slammed the door near us and we all jumped. Because it was creepy and it was really fun. Our GM did a really great job of building the mood on that one. Our keeper, I should say. But that's partially just the nature of playing a lot of one-shots and playing a lot of games that you know aren't going to go anywhere, is that, like, even the Deviant playtest that we did at Midwinter, like, I can see Deviant being very creepy, obviously, like, you were changed against your will, but we were playing for 4 hours on a cruise ship, and we were trying to break the game a little because it was a playtest. So we were doing stupid things. Like, like Neil's character just kind of ran off to confront the bad guys, and all of us were like, I guess we should follow him. I guess we're doing this now. But, you know, it was the right thing to do to go ahead and move the plot forward. For that instance. I guess he the exact same scenario we were doing, being super creepy, if played over like 3 days, because it was, you know, a few days on a cruise ship. But I'm like, this is pretty cool. So, yeah.
So I've been able to, I guess, evoke fear and revulsion from tabletop games at conventions if they are signposted as horror games and marked like 18 and over for role players. You know, all necessary warnings put in place. I've mentioned before, I think I ran a Hunt of the Vigil game across 3 different years at the same convention, and had some of the same players turn up each time, which was lovely, but it was one of the more grotesque games I've done. Definitely the horror, and it was pretty vulgar, but everything was signposted for that, and so there was a certain level of investment beforehand from the players. You know, they knew what they were getting into, and they knew to approach it with a certain level of seriousness. And the reactions as a result were great. And they all felt like, well, this was a really rewarding experience, because we don't usually get a genuine horror game at a convention. So, you know, it is possible, but I completely agree. I think most part because, as you say, people don't know each other as well. People just want to stress test systems and just have a bit of fun with their characters. There's often a more lighthearted attitude towards convention gameplay.
I have also just had an epiphany, like epiphany. Like, I've been sitting here, like, furrowing my brow while you've been talking, thinking about this.
Please, go ahead.
I am a really visual person, because you're talking about, like, really grotesque horror and all this other stuff, and I'm like, so? And then I thought about it, and I'm like, wait a minute, there are some scenes in horror movies that I can't watch because they gross me out. Not usually gore, but, like, other, like, I'm not okay with, like, vomit and stuff. But I listen to so many true crime podcasts that describe grotesque actual things that happen, and I read a ton of books and thrillers and things like that, but it, like, if I'm gonna have the actual fear or the actual, like, cry react, it's almost always a movie, TV show, video game, something like that. So that might be another reason that I don't get so wrapped up in role-playing characters.
Yeah, because tabletop role-playing games are ultimately audio.
Right, I mean, we've talked before how I'm a you know, kinesthetic learner. Like, I'm very tactile. Even in college, I absorbed lectures better if I was doing something like sketching or crocheting through the whole thing, which luckily my professors were cool enough to let me do. But, like, when we record this podcast, I am often playing stupid games on my phone the whole time, because I pay better attention to what you two are saying if I'm doing something. Otherwise, I start thinking about other stuff or looking around at things in the room, and I get distracted because I have a touch of ADD. And that's all. Yeah. So that's the thing about myself I just learned, is that I am much more visual, because I used to read, like, I don't really anymore, but I used to read books that were marked as, you know, splatterpunk as a genre, which is super gross out horror. For those of you that don't know, don't pick one up if you're not okay with that. It's super gross out horror. And yeah, occasionally I'd get a little queasy and be like, ooh, no, can't read this one while I'm eating. But I still read them. And, like, I guess, and I don't know if I enjoyed them or if I just thought I was being real hardcore and cool. Because, you know, I was reading these when I was like 18. But, but I still read them, and I still did, you know, like them on some level, and I still do read a lot of horror and everything, and it just doesn't really get to me. Yeah, but if I watch something, like, totally, I'll still get freaked out sometimes.
Well, here's something to explore in this revelatory. Is it revelatory or revelatory? I've always said revelatory. Anyway, in this revelation of a podcast, it's anger. And specifically out of character anger. It's something I mentioned at in our Monday meeting, actually, is I am very prone to what I call, and a lot of people call, table talk. So if I'm playing a board game or a competitive card game, I will role play a greater sense of indignation than I'm actually experiencing, or whether it's with a teammate or whether it's because I'm losing, and it's because I and often the people I play with regularly find it more fun. but the I need to measure that when I'm playing with people I don't know, because they will probably think I'm genuinely outraged. And that said, I know I've also roleplayed with people that do genuinely have outbursts of anger when their characters die, when the plot goes in a way they don't like. And so, as a bit of a confessional, Eddie, have you ever been angry out of character at the table and let it bleed through into the way you act, the way you, I guess, the way you display to the other players?
Yes.
Ooh, do tell.
And in fact, So the Mindset Society, which is an ongoing live action group for World Darkness, they have, at different times in its existence, had different stances on alcohol use. I have realized that if I am really wound up out of character, and if I have a few drinks, and if I'm in a situation where I'm acting out of anger, it's really hard for me to separate those lines. So there have been times where people have, I've escalated the situation in character, and people have asked for de-escalation, and it was difficult for me to do that. And that's why I was like, cool, I need to stop drinking at games, period. I'm done. Luckily I was able to recognize that, because my family has a long history of alcoholism, yada, yada. Another podcast. Point is, I saw that and said, I can get up to stop that, but I've seen lots of people who can't.
Right.
And it's not always alcohol. Certainly some people are on medications that can affect their emotional impact and whatnot. But certainly I have, and I've also seen others who get so wound up, whether it's the scene winding them up or they're frustrated at a rules call, and they sometimes burst out. One thing, when I was running a live action game, I instituted rules like anyone can walk away for any reason. And they just say, out of character, I need a minute, and they walk off. And everyone else will stop, because I know I needed that sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And it really helped, I think, in a lot of cases. Tabletop games, they're doing a lot more at conventions, the X card, where you put a card in the middle of the table, and someone could point to it and say, we're done with the scene, and they don't have to explain it. The game master then kind of moves to a different direction. And those kinds of tools, I think, really, really help. But I have certainly seen, to my shame, I once threw an empty soda can at someone at a live action game because I was so angry at them. I was very young and very stupid, but it happened. And when I did that, I realized I need to stop. But I've seen other people do similar things. It can be very frustrating.
No, as we're in the confessional stage of this podcast, I punched someone in the chest at Convention of Thorns. Mm-hmm. And it was because I was feeling incredibly crowded and anxious, I guess, and no one seemed to be listening to my, well, identifying the hand gestures that I was making. I'm out of character. I want to get out of this cramped corridor and to the area where we can get photographed. But because I'd almost created a rod for my own back, because over the previous 2 days, I had been getting involved in more political plotting than anyone else in the entire game. I was determined to find a way to make my character survive through to the end of the game, which was no small feat as the only Cappadocian there. And I'd managed it. I'd managed to get the Cappadocians admitted to the Camarilla, and the Giovanni declared devil kindred, and open an amnesty to Giovanni who wanted to rename themselves Cappadocius as a surname, and all this kind of fun stuff. It was great. But the result was I had become connected to pretty much every other mover and shaker in the game. And on the third night, we were invited to have photographs taken in the Grand Hall. And to get there, I had to go through this very narrow corridor. We were in a castle. And so I was trying to navigate my way there with my hand above my head to identify that I was out of character. But no one, because everyone wanted to get their last roleplay, and it was a 3-night roleplay. And they saw me, and everyone was using this damn corridor. And so people were just gravitating to me and saying, "My Lord Camden," and all this other stuff. And I was saying, "I'm out of character. I'm trying to get a photo. I just got one question for you. No, I just want to get my photos taken. Please, you know, this is important to my role play." And by the end of it, I had a dozen to 20 people in this corridor. And that's not an exaggeration. Clara Herbel was there as well, and she can attest to this, that I was fuming that no one was listening to me, to the point that someone ended up coming up to me and saying something like, "My Lord Camden," and I just lashed out. And that's something I don't do. I'm not a violent person by nature, but I had reached the boiling point. And I was, of course, incredibly apologetic afterwards. Thankfully, he didn't mind. Terran actually understood the situation and apologized himself. But I've had that excess of anger, and it was completely out of character. But in a role-playing environment, when people don't necessarily always understand what's in character and what's out of character, and people have certain desires they want to get across in a scene, it can be a grey area that needs to be more easily defined. And that's why I lose my patience with people that say they don't like the X card. I know that's kind of not the point, but I find the prop so inoffensive to have in the middle of the table. This wonderful idea that every single person has the possibility of saying, "Nope, that's enough for me." And just move on, and everyone can be fine with it. I don't see why that is an issue for some people. There's part of me that wonders, is it something that can be incorporated more into game mechanics? Like, if I was to do They Came From Again, should everyone have the possibility of having a missing reel? So everyone basically possesses an X card as an ability. So the people that complain that this out-of-character interference is ruining my gameplay no longer can call it out-of-character. But at the same time, I feel like, well, it's not actually an offensive prop, so maybe it's something that you should learn to have at the table. The confessional's taken a downward turn in terms of mood. But I think it's important to identify the areas you as role players sometimes struggle. Mm-hmm. Whether it's, some people really struggle when their character dies. I've seen, when I used to attend a gaming club regularly, I know of a player who kicked his chair across the hall, took his battle map, he rolled the battle map up that was on the table, and then launched it over a fence outside. He was that angry that his character had died. And unfortunately, it was on private property he couldn't access. He just lost his battle map there. And I've known all kinds of people like that, but they're not always angry. Some people, of course, more prone to being sad at the table, or happy, or afraid, I love it when a player can genuinely channel fear into a game of Call of Cthulhu.
Well, before we get too far into that, I want to talk about my anger experience, because you didn't ask me.
Sorry, I didn't know that. I didn't know that you had one. My apologies. Please do.
I'm gonna call you out on that, because I told you before the podcast that I have been angry many times at tables, because you asked me. And also, I think that women often don't get to be angry. So, yeah. No,
that's a good point.
Most of my experiences with it have been usually at either another player doing something that I thought was being a jerk, essentially, just for being a jerk's sake, or the GM making what I thought was a poor decision, either narratively or, forcing my character into something that I didn't think they should be. Mm-hmm. The most recent example of that was a D&D game I was playing where I will admit I was in the wrong as to my reaction, in that I got a little sullen and a little just pissed off for the rest of the session. But there was this, we're playing D&D, there was this thing we had found, we had a task to get it to somewhere else, and that was the most important thing. And my GM and that created a situation in which I couldn't hold on to it. Like, I tried everything, we tried 18 solutions, because there was something coming after us trying to get it. And essentially it was, nope, it's getting taken from you. And I was like, but that was our entire plot, was getting this thing to the other place. I didn't know that he had other plans in place. So all I knew is that my character's motivation was to hold on to this thing. And so when it was taken from me, I got really mad. Like, out of character. Because I was like, that was a terrible call. Why would you do that? I have no reason to even be with these other people anymore, because my entire reason was to take this thing based on the boss I have or whatever. Uh-huh. And so, like, why am I even playing this game anymore? And it kind of spiraled into that kind of emotion. Yeah. And apparently I didn't trust him enough to keep it going. That was my fault. You know, I definitely shouldn't have gotten as annoyed about it as I did. But it just kind of, like, one of the things about having depression and anxiety is that sometimes a very tiny, like, bad feeling will spiral very quickly if you don't cut it off at the beginning. And I didn't realize how bad it was getting until it had turned into everything is terrible. Why the fuck am I playing this game? You know?
Mm-hmm.
If I catch it at the beginning and I catch kind of a like bad feeling, I can usually kind of go like, no, just keep playing, move on with your life. It's fine. You know, mm-hmm. or keep doing like, and that applies to how I feel about my personal life, personal relationships too, is that if I let something fester for even like a couple of hours, it is exponentially worse than it is if I, you know, cut it off in the first 10 minutes. But yeah, so most of my, you know, anger stuff has been that generally you're playing with friends and I can go kind of work it out.
Right.
In this situation, the DM and I weren't super close. Like, we were friends, we were friendly, but we weren't, like, hang outside of the game or my workplace friends.
Right.
So I didn't really feel, like, comfortable with it, and then that led to a whole host of other issues. So, yeah, it's definitely happened. I've got other examples from, like, old vampire games where I had one friend who was just too committed to being in character, so he wouldn't do anything that could possibly be out of character for him, even a little tiny bit. And so, like, we were playing a mage game, and we had to go to Europe,
uh-huh.
and he wouldn't get on a damn plane. Because he was like, the technocracy, scan technocracy, I can't go to... I'm like, Jesus Christ, Mike. And it got to a point where we were like, can we just hand wave it? And he's like, no, I'm not going. We're like, fine, stay here. And guess what? That was the last session we ever played of that mage game. Because he killed it. He murdered the game. And I get annoyed about that.
So
that's part of my experience, is that I tend to get angry. If I'm bored, if my character's being given nothing to do, I have trouble keeping that off my face. Like, if I'm trying to engage and I can't for some reason, because there's just nothing that's working for my character. Like, mm-hmm. All this is a, like, the next 10 things you're doing are a strength test. And I'm like, cool, I'm playing the charisma character. I'm gonna do nothing. Great. I get annoyed about that because I always feel like that's just kind of not great storytelling. It's not letting everybody be involved.
It definitely feels justified, though. I mean, we're going to have to wrap up soon, but I think one of the most painful displays of sexism that I've witnessed at the gaming table was one of the first role-playing games I played, which was a Star Wars RPG. And the GM, so there were two women at the table. GM was male, and the GM... made sure that the women could only play a princess and her personal guard, who was never allowed to leave her side, and they never got any plot that had us sort of venturing out into the planet and doing adventure-y stuff. They always had to just keep her safe. It was a permanent escort mission for them.
Yeah, great.
And quite rightly, the two players got very annoyed and they left the table. And I wish I'd been more, I guess, responsible, mature, bold at the time to call it out and say, you know, this isn't on. I think I was so new to the hobby at that point that I just was too afraid to speak up and say that this isn't cool. But I think anger at the table can be justified, but obviously it's the finding the right way to convey it. And as long as you're not the one that screws up the game, I guess, but the game is far less important than the feelings of the players at the table.
Yeah.
So,
after now that I know so much more about like safety rules and trauma rules and even just rules for dealing with your emotions, I think that if I could go back and play that session again, I would have called a timeout after that happened and kind of been like, hey, I really don't understand, like, what you're doing here, because this is literally our only mission. So can you just, like, reassure me that this is going to be a thing later? And he would have been like, yeah, totally. And I would have been like, okay, cool. You know? And I would have, like, calmed down.
Mm-hmm.
But calling time out to the table isn't something that I'm used to doing. Ooh, someone's ringing.
Yeah, my phone, which should be turned off, is not somehow.
Bing, oh, well, maybe it's someone calling to say, we've reached the end of our podcast. What a wonderful segue.
Hey, stop talking.
On that happy note, Dixie, if people want to find you online, where would they go?
As always, you can find me, Dixie Cyanide, on just about everything, Twitter, Instagram. Don't friend me on Facebook, that's weird. and I do have my editing website, DixieCochran.com, which is mostly just a list of things I've worked on.
And Eddie?
Apparently you can call me by phone, it turns out.
I'm going to call Eddie right now.
Right, but aside from that, you can find me on Twitter, Instagram, as Eddie Fate, EddyFate. That's also the name of my personal website. Find me on Facebook as Eddie Webb Writer. You can check out all my professional stuff at pugsteady.com. And if you want to know more about Pugmire, you can find everything at realmsofpugmire.com.
And you can find me on YouTube as The Gentleman Gamer on the Onyx Path channel. You can find me on my website, matthewdawkins.com, and Patreon as Matthew Dawkins. You can find me on Twitter as ClackClickBang. You can find me on the Onyx Path forum as The Gentleman Gamer. And I think, and Facebook as The Gentleman Gamer as well. So, with that said, thank you very much for listening. Many worlds, one podcast.